The Wake Up Call with Richard Martin, Mondays and Fridays at 10 a.m. on the Progressive Radio Network. Please be advised that the opinions and views expressed by Richard Martin of GF Investment Services, LLC, are entirely his own and do not necessarily represent the views of the company, its affiliates, or its officers. Investments based off of Richard Martin's comments are unsolicited by the company and are at the sole risk and prejudice of the listener and the investor.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is Richard Martin here with the Wake Up Call coming to you on a Monday, the 22nd of November, 2010. And as we all look forward to Thanksgiving, unfortunately, I'm afraid, 'tis the season of discontent rather than to be jolly. We are in such dire circumstances that nobody will be able to put Humpty Dumpty back together again. If you simply take the total U.S. national debt since 1940, it has risen to $11.9 trillion by 2009, of which $8.16 trillion has been interest expenditures. The total amount of interest paid out since 1940 accounts 68% of the total national debt. Ladies and gentlemen, this is a truly staggering number that is beyond contemplation. It is what currently drives all the markets and has sent the talking heads talking in circles. We are rapidly crossing that point of no return. The government turns to the New York bankers for advice. That is like a drug addict going to the drug dealers to ask advice if he should stop taking drugs. When the New York bankers are primary dealers who sell the debt, they cannot give any advice on the subject of debt. So if ever my death wish contention ever had meaning, it is right here that we are in a truly hopeless death spiral, and there is nobody to call and say, help, fix it. You know, history buries empires, nations, and cities all in a common grave. So many have fallen thanks to an irresponsible debt crisis. It is hard to list all the failures. Some are indeed memorable. For it is not some magical cycle that causes the mass burials, but that the passions of man never change. And thus we find that history repeats because government is always and without exception corrupted to the point that government always dies by its own hand. One of the best examples from the long history of common graves in which empires, nations, and cities are buried, demonstrating that debt alone can destroy a government, is from the city of Mainz, Germany. It was the excessive debt and the incompetent management of the government that destroyed the city. The parallel of America's government current public debt crisis has often been drawn to Rome, but the comparisons are similar only to a point. It was the incompetence of the management of government, the squandering of public resources, and the excessive taxation that truly undermined Rome as an empire. Yet there was the evolution from a conquest economic model, whereas the state gained economic benefit by conquering another and taking all its gold. That conquest model collapsed when they ran out of new countries to conquer. Then Rome turned inward against its own people, taxing them to the point of driving industry and capital out of Rome. The United States has followed that course of events, but it has not yet been confronted by the barbarians at the gate that leads to massive military expenditures to the point that at the time of Constantine, it was said that there were more government people than there were taxpayers. That is the real key that ultimately brings down the house of cards. And this is the crisis of which I have focused upon that is creating the debt crisis. It was the very government employees rioting in Greece. It was trying to push retirement back by 2 years in France that led to their riots. Now there are serious issues arising in Britain that will soon be felt in the United States of America. The political collapse of Mainz is a clean example of the crisis in debt that we face today. The city of Mainz had gained its rights to be self-governing in 1118. It had become a free city in 1244. But the corrupt management of the city was pervasive. From about 1332 onwards, the trade guilds, the unions, became deeply involved in managing the government that managed to stem the tide of any economic crisis until 1411. Mainz was the birthplace of printing in Western Europe. Johannes Gutenberg, who had invented movable type for printing about 1440, and this period had been known as the Age of Golden Mainz, fueled largely by debt and the good times. To have funded the city's golden age and its freedom, it was building a national debt with perpetual deficits year after year. The debt crisis that was brewing was truly massive. From the outside, looking in, Mainz was the symbol of wealth. It was the envy of all, and it appeared to be the land of milk and honey. However, in 1411, the cracks in the looking glass began to appear. The debt crisis was multiplying like a virus in a lab dish. Taxes were now rising, and a political upheaval was in motion. The payments on its debt reached a crisis point, and 48% of the expenditure now went to interest to roll the debt. In 1411, there was a popular uprising that now forbade the sale of any more debt without the consent of the trade guilds. Yet the financial conditions continued to worsen. By 1436 to 1437, about 75% of the total city expenditure was now being consumed by interest. Interest rates began to rise as there were subtle fears that Mainz might not be able to repay its debts. The interest rates climbed to find buyers for the debt. The interest rates jumped from 3 to 5% during the 1430s. By 1444, the total debt of the city of Mainz had now reached 373,184 gulden. The amount of money owed was truly staggering for a city. In 1448, the city tried to sell just 21,000 gulden to roll over debt coming due. There was no bid. The crisis that hit showed that 60% of its debt was held by people outside the city, foreign debt holders. The city was forced to default and the fun just began. Because of this high external debt, the city lost its independence. Mainz was now seized and placed under an imperial ban by the Holy Roman Empire. The Pope excommunicated the city for being a borrower under the sin of usury. The rich fled the city, which began prior to the bankruptcy. They held their capital and wealth outside Mainz, just as capital remains offshore today because of taxes. Deserted by the rich, the city became impoverished. It was captured and then set on fire for retribution. It is hard at times to overcome the misconceptions that are propagated by those who wish to comment on historical events without doing the full research to comprehend what actually takes place. The Great Depression is the classic example of misconception. To a fish in a curved bowl, his view of reality will be distorted according to the curve of the bowl. It will be like a funhouse mirror that makes you look weird. The problem that we face is always one of perspective. If you analyze everything from a US perspective, you cannot see what the rest of the world sees. We are always hampered by our biased perspective. The greatest problem we face is the lack of true comprehension about how things work. Take the stock market to zero and it will not create a depression. Wipe out real estate. You wipe out everything for people believe this was their savings. Mortgages were about 74% of total consumer debt. Wipe out the debt markets and you get Mainz. It is a delicate mix of the level of debt, the interest rate, the distribution between domestic and foreign holders, and the percent of total expenditure that is unfunded compared to the tax rate. Putting this all together globally reveals the big winner and losers. The debt crisis in Europe is far from over, and as the Wall Street Journal reported on November the 10th, Ireland tied its fate to the banks. The debt crisis reported before placed the damage at 50 billion euros. Or as the journal stated, quote, nearly $50,000 for every household in the Emerald Isle. End of quote. The point is this. The bankers are far from experts on the world economy. The bankers do not understand the global economy or how markets actually develop, rise, bubble, and crash. Yet governments constantly call these people. Ireland is hit hard by the incompetent banking system that is by far not limited to Ireland. Even Goldman Sachs had to be bailed out to survive. Yet people will listen to bankers and hang on their every word as if they know what they really are doing anyway. Ireland is imploding. It is in a debt crisis implosion that is being caused by the massive bad loans and leverage the banks got themselves into, and that suppresses the real estate market, which in turn creates the economic decline, and that cuts into the tax revenue that then forces a reduction in government. We are watching these dynamic forces feed into each other. This is not a simple liquidity crisis. If it was just that simple, pouring trillions into the banks was the wrong move. The banks were the first blush of the problem, but that was the least of it. You cannot save the banks of the nation without understanding the real crisis. The fate of the Irish banks will still be shared by others. We are in a contagion crisis. As the banks foreclose, they depress the real estate that depresses consumer spending when they fear their savings are gone, and that depresses revenues for the government and forces higher taxes, lower economic growth, and increasing the odds of political upheavals, revolutions, and war. So throw everyone out onto the street and throw 40% of the houses up for sale. The depression will be massive. Real estate is dead for decades. There will be sudden rallies, but the game is over. They created the 30-year mortgage to restart the real estate market back during the depression. How do you expect to do that now without any such tool? This is more than just forcing people out of their homes and selling them for scraps. The powers that be are assuming that people will jump in back and that the housing will rise in price. The NASDAQ bubble was in 2000. The market didn't come back yet, did it? It ain't going to happen. and it isn't going to come back for real estate either. Okay, this is Richard Martin. This is the wake-up call, and the toll-free number for you to call in, please, 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 ladies and gentlemen, it is 888-874-4888. That is our toll-free number for your use, and please use it and let us hear some of your views and opinions on all subjects to do with finances and the economy. The more, the merrier. Once more, the number for you to call is 888-874-4888. If you would like to email in your contributions, that is possible too. The email is open at all times, and it is the address rm@gfawd.com. Again, RM for Richard Martin, GFAWD for Global Financial Advisory Wealth Design.com. Once more, RM@gfawd.com. And if you want to call me in private to discuss your individual issues away from the ears of company present, you may do that by calling a Sarasota, Florida number at area code 941-441-1682. That is my number, a direct line to me in Singapore, and if I'm not here, leave a message, a name and a phone number, and I will call you back. Once again, the number is 941-441-1682. Okay, well, if you're looking for when the trouble all began, you've got to go back to 1913, when the Fed and centralized planning was established. And every succeeding generation has ignored the fact that counterfeiting money and lending it at interest is a scheme that has catastrophically failed in all previous attempts, and consequently the victims deserve what eventually befalls them. The problem with maintaining inflation at 3% is that it compounds until the curve approaches vertical. This exponential growth will eventually outpace real productivity, and therefore at some point fake prosperity has to be created through expansion of credit. What's happening today could have been and probably was predicted well before 1913. But politics trumped reason. The effects being experienced today inevitably had to materialize. Mathematically, there is, was, and could be no other outcome. As real productive activity decreased, credit had to be expanded at exponentially increasing rates until exhaustion. Exhaustion occurs at the point where the curve approaches vertical, where infinite credit or money has to be injected ad infinitum. Well, of course, this is impossible, and it's why all efforts thus far have failed. Credit is being destroyed faster than it can be created. Those demanding that you tender solutions do not understand that the $106 trillion gorilla in the room cannot be satisfied. And what is so egregious is that the boomer generation should have seen it coming. Instead of tackling a very difficult problem, they chose distraction by bread and circuses. That the most technologically advanced country in history could conceive of sending worthless pieces of paper to China so that they could buy worthless treasuries, so that we could continue to purchase things that required real human effort and natural resources, is either collective insanity, rank stupidity, desperation, or just plain old greed. And now that we have engaged in this type of activity for decades and the comeuppance is upon us, we demand solutions to avoid the inevitable consequences of ineptitude and apathy. The situation is untenable. That an insolvent government, starting from a $106 trillion deficit and facing global peak resource utilization will somehow effectively manage to administer to a huge retired population who have no savings, assets that they will only be able to sell at a loss, and pensions denominated in a worthless currency, as a line of thought, is at best imprudent. This grand cycle top is unlike any other faced by mankind. We are at peak water, peak industrialism, peak credit, and maybe even peak population. There is and will be no excess capacity for growth. The very mechanisms that have allowed Homo sapiens to reach such high levels of population density are at or near exhaustion. Ladies and gentlemen, I am unable to express with words the horror of this crisis. It is only your imaginations which offer the limits of the horizons as to how terrifying this all is. Anybody who tells you what the solution is or will be is lying, because nobody can possibly envisage the way in which all this will be resolved. You know, Bernanke says he wants prices to rise 2% a year. One problem is he doesn't count food, energy, or housing. Although the OER, or owner's equivalent rent, is the largest component of housing, rent and housing prices are two different things. Property taxes and sales taxes are yet another thing, and those are not factored into the CPI either. America is clearly following the path of Japan, especially if we include housing and equity prices, including the NASDAQ. Yet to the pocketbook of the average U.S. citizen, costs are going up, wages and benefits are going down, except, of course, for Wall Street and public employees. Regardless of what your position is regarding measuring inflation, prices, or credit-based, Bernanke is horrendously wrong. It is sheer madness in a world of global wage arbitrage, where 14 million people are unemployed, where the unemployment rate is close to 10%, to pursue a policy of attempting to force prices up, to meet some asinine idea that prices need to rise 2% a year, when to the perspective of the average consumer, prices are going up much more than that, via taxes alone, let alone the grocery store and gasoline pump. Bernanke's policies are just as mad from the perspective of credit. In a fiat credit-based regime, there will be no significant sustainable hiring or economic growth when consumer and business credit is collapsing. Net credit creation has been negative for 10 quarters. Bernanke is attempting to stimulate lending, and the Fed can print all the money at once. But the Fed cannot force banks to lend or consumers to borrow. For now, Bernanke's efforts have caused rising commodity prices, which is hurting small businesses that cannot pass on those price increases because consumers are tapped out. The net effect of the policies of this Fed and this administration is small businesses getting crucified in a price squeeze. So whether you view inflation from a price perspective or from the proper perspective of credit expansion, Bernanke is simply wrong. His policies have failed and will continue to fail. He needs to be stopped. Who is going to step up to the plate? You know, what's happening in Ireland right now is not at root a sovereign debt crisis. It's just another banking crisis. The reason it has spilled over into a problem of national solvency is that it has overwhelmed the country's capacity to afford further bailouts. And by the same token, the reason European policymakers are trying to force a rescue package on the reluctant Brian Cowen, the Irish Prime Minister, is not because Ireland has run out of money. In fact, its debt is fully funded until the middle of next year. It's because they fear Ireland's banking crisis will become their own, as bad loans to Irish banks trigger a wave of insolvencies across Europe. They also worry that excessive use by Irish banks of European central bank liquidity, as everyone else dashes to get their money out, is undermining the ECB's integrity, and therefore that of the euro as a whole. The problem is you cannot ultimately fix an underlying solvency problem by forcing a country to borrow even more. That only further reduces the chances of the debt ever being repaid. How hard is it to understand this? And if markets begin to believe that the countries on the periphery of the Eurozone will be permanently underwritten by the rest, it will weaken the creditworthiness of the core. Well, one thing is for sure. Taxpayers could no longer be expected to pay the costs of all this rotten lending. That game of bail us out or suffer the consequences has been played for long enough. It's not just intolerable. It's become part of the problem. All right, well, here is a short email from somebody called DJ Watt. I don't know what that stands for, but anyway, that's who he is, and this is what he has to say. Hello, Richard. Fortunately, I am able to download your program. Per your wise advice, I have divested my USA assets and now hold all my money. There is much talk of the dollar collapse and hyperinflation. I remember listening to you speak that our greatest fear at the moment is that of deflation and not hyperinflation. As you are quite thorough, I know that you must have explained it to your listeners in great detail. To make it simple for me, and I suspect some others, what is the denominator? The money supply? When the Fed whimsically prints money, I was relating it a dilution that one takes when a company issues additional stock. The value of each share, dollars in our case, is devalued, hence inflation. Also, with all this talk of the US dollar going south, what currencies would you suggest we invest in at this time? Finally, how do we acquire a foreign bank account or an account held in currencies other than our own? Thank you for all of your efforts to inform us, your listening audience. Have a great day. DJ Watt. All right, DJ, well, a couple of questions there, and I shall attempt to supply the answers. You make a big mistake, if I may suggest, when you liken the printing of money to printing, or rather, distributing additional stock. You are correct. Additional stock is dilutive, and you can expect, overall, the price of the stocks in that company to fall, since each stock covers a smaller portion of ownership in the company as additional stock is issued. Now, what's happening with additional dollars is that indeed, in a sense, you're correct because the value of those dollars goes down. But where you're incorrect is that because of the amount of defaults in the system currently taking place, of bankruptcies, foreclosures, defaults of one sort or another, the amount of money leaving the system through all of these defaults is overwhelming the amount of money that is being printed and put into the system. And that is why, net-net, there are fewer dollars in the system almost constantly. And that's why the dollar is not collapsing as you might think it should or would. In fact, as we speak today, the dollar is up on the day, the euro is down. That may have something to do with the Irish question, I don't know. But basically, you cannot assume that the dollar is just going to collapse. You know, if there's $1.5 trillion being printed up and thrown into the mix by the Federal Reserve, and there are $43 trillion of debts being currently unwound and deleveraged and just let go through bankruptcy of one sort or another, I'm afraid that the money coming out is, as you can see, vastly superior to the amount of money coming in. So it's not quite the dilution that you are referring to, but it's a good stab. So therefore, as things are right now, DJ, I would stay with the dollar. I wouldn't go to foreign currencies. What you'd like to know about a foreign bank account, there are various ways in which you can go about this, but it's getting harder and harder. You know, people don't want Americans using foreign bank accounts basically to launder money, even if it's just to shield it from the IRS. I mean, ask the Swiss how they feel about that. And it is hard, even if you're going to live in country. When I came to live in Singapore, it was very hard for me to open a personal bank account until I actually came to live here and was able to produce a rental document and a few other credentials showing that my employment permit was valid and that I was, in fact, entitled to a bank account. So don't think it's all peaches and cream. Now, there are some places like in Argentina where it's very easy to open a foreign bank account. The question is whether you would want to have an account in Argentina. That's another matter. Panama is said to be quite easy as well. Ecuador is not too hard. Both countries use the American dollar, so that's an advantage. Some of the tax havens, I think, might not be too hard, but again, things change so fast in these places, it's not really easy to give a blanket opinion on these matters. But anyway, I hope that's given you some idea. Thank you for your email, and thank you for wishing me a great day. I wish you a great day as well, DJ. Hope you're enjoying the show. All right, well, I think it's time to take a break, so let's do that, and I will be right back.
You are listening to PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
This is Glenn Ford. Join me and co-host Nellie Bailey every Monday at 5 p.m. Eastern Time for Black Agenda Radio, an hour of news, analysis, and commentary from a black left perspective. That's Black Agenda Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.
This is John Rappaport inviting you to my new radio show on the Progressive Radio Network, which will air every Wednesday at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. I'm an investigative reporter. I've spent 20 years researching health and medical fraud, deep politics. I'll have lots of very knowledgeable guests on the show who have information to share with you so that you can live a more healthy and informed life. Join me every Wednesday on PRN. That's 7 p.m. Eastern Time, the John Rappaport Show. See you then.
I've been on radio for 37 years, every day, and I'm pleased that the Progressive Radio Network exists, because this is the one forum that brings together some of the most important, probing, creative, and dynamic minds on the planet. Join us each and every day, 24/7, on the Progressive Radio Network, your home for independent thinking.
This is Mitchell J. Rabin to tell you that we have two new time slots every Monday and Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on Progressive Radio Network. Join me as I interview and dialogue with the sung and unsung heroes of society with passion and with commitment. Scientists, healers, filmmakers, musicians, environmentalists, and gurus on Mondays, and a call-in show where you'll be the focus on Wednesdays. Again, Monday and Wednesday at 6 p.m., join Mitchell Rabin as together we create a better world.
Thank you. This is PRN, Progressive Radio Network, your voice for independent views.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, we are back. And once more, I am going to exhort you to get out of the stock market. If you have any investments in the stock market, if you have any mutual funds, if you have anything in 401ks of a stock nature, or a mutual fund, or a unit trust, or anything in insurance where you have a variable annuity invested in stocks, ladies and gentlemen, get out of these things as fast as you can. I made this point many times in the past about the housing market, about municipal bonds, about the stock market. Now my turn is really focused on the stock market. It is going to collapse, ladies and gentlemen. You need to be out of it. Now, I don't know how many people, in fact, did liquidate your housing as a result of the exhortations that I made years back before the housing market started to implode. But if you didn't, it's not too late. And it's certainly not too late at this point to get your stuff out of the stock market. But I don't know of many people who do have stocks. I don't know many people who are considering going short in the market, which is an excellent thing to be doing. Anybody who's already short, you will do very well in the future to come. We are following the Japanese example. This is a grim period in history. It is going to lead to ever worse things. It's going to lead to a major war. It's going to lead to things that nobody can even begin to imagine. And so, you know, if you have any investment in assets of any kind whatsoever, get rid of them, ladies and gentlemen. Just do it. Don't ask questions. Whatever you do, don't ask anybody that has an interest in keeping you in these things. Just make your decision and take the action you need to take in order to achieve these ends, namely the liquidation of all assets of any kind and remain either in cash or in short-term treasury bills and their money market equivalent, or short in the stock market. And that's it. That's all you need to know, and it's all you need to do. And then when you've done that, make your plans to move out of the United States. We will talk more about this as time goes by, as I see things degenerating to the point at which I sense that I have a more sympathetic listenership to that particular advice. I will spend much more time talking about it, because that's going to become absolutely paramount in the months to come. But at the moment, I'm seeing still some degree of resistance to that, so I'm not going to irritate the listenership with, you know, more and more information about this. I'll give you some information as time goes by, but as things really do ramp up, and right now the horror stories of what's going on with the TSA and the way in which your government is simply riding roughshod over your freedoms, your liberties, it leaves me speechless, but nevertheless, it's a word to the wise, ladies and gentlemen, and the word is not don't travel by plane. The word is don't put yourself in any kind of position where you might even have to travel by plane. Go somewhere else. I'm telling you, this is going to get worse. More and more of your liberties will be removed from you, and eventually you'll look around and say, why didn't I take his advice when I could have? So anyway, this will tie in, of course, with your opening bank accounts in all sorts of different places. So DJ's question was actually well positioned for the logistical needs of anybody who is considering leaving. But be that as it may, you have been warned. You know, anyone who's being paying attention knows that the idea that the U.S. is recovering, it's just that. It's just an idea conjured up in the minds of sort of giddy Wall Street traders and ivory tower economists. No segment of the economy is more aware of the true state of affairs than the small business sector, which has been a traditional locomotive for growth in the U.S. small business is seeing little evidence of a light at the end of any tunnel. While export-driven profits increase for multinationals, most small businesses in the U.S. are being left far behind. Their sales are declining, and that's a drag on hiring. The recovery that began in the middle of last year has not reached the small business yet. And while corporate profits approach pre-recession levels, income at the small private companies is recovering much more slowly, if at all, and that's according to the data from the Bureau of Economic Analysis. Proprietors' income, that's the profits of unincorporated businesses such as partnerships or individual work themselves, is down nearly 5% from 2 years ago, while corporate profits have jumped 21% in that period, according to the BEA. The uneven recovery of small companies stems partly from the diverging fortunes of the U.S. and faster-growing countries. Many big corporations are seeing strong sales from their overseas operations, while smaller companies tend to sell primarily to customers in the U.S., and that's according to Drew White, who's chief financial officer at accounting software company SageWorks, which collects and analyzes financial data from hundreds of thousands of private companies. And I quote from White, small businesses are probably going to get revenue later in the business cycle than the big businesses that are exporting to growing markets internationally. Large companies can have the ability to shift markets if they see demand. End of quote. Well, despite the usual trope that small businesses are engines of job growth, larger companies actually seem to be doing the most hiring these days, and that's according to new Gallup survey data. In a recent poll asking Americans whether their companies were hiring, reducing their workforces, or just staying the same size, people at the largest companies were most likely to say their staffs were growing. Just 9% of people who worked at companies with fewer than 10 employees said their companies were hiring, compared to 42% of people who worked at companies with at least 1,000 employees. Fewer new businesses are getting off the ground in the U.S., according to available data, which could cloud the prospects for job growth and innovation. Startups of job-creating companies have failed to keep pace with closings, and even those concerns that do get launched are hiring less than in the past. The number of companies with at least one employee fell by 100,000 or 2% in the year ended March the 31st, according to the Labor Department on Thursday. That was the second worst performance in 18 years, the worst being the 3.4% drop in the previous year. Newly opened companies created a seasonally adjusted total of 2.6 million jobs in the three quarters ended in March, 15% less than in the first three quarters of the last recovery when investors and entrepreneurs were still digging their way out of the internet bust. Research shows that new businesses are the most important source of jobs and a key driver of the innovation and productivity gains that raise long-term living standards. Without them, there would be no net job growth at all, say economists John Heitelwanger at the University of Maryland and Ron Jamin and Javier Miranda of the Census Bureau. The so-called Great Recession, the longest since World War II, will have an even more prolonged effect on the economy if small businesses continue to be unable to secure capital. Despite significant government stimulus to banks and lending institutions, small business lending is actually down over the past 2 years. And the reason the banking industry isn't lending to small businesses during a period in the economic cycle when it's absolutely essential has a lot to do with creditworthiness. Banks claim it's hard to find qualified applicants, and for the most part, they believe the majority of small businesses simply aren't creditworthy. And in this economy, banks are not willing to take a risk, and as a result, business lending suffers. The latest statistics from the Federal Reserve Bank of New York show more than 75% of small businesses that applied for a loan during the first half of 2010 didn't receive the credit they needed. Since the recession was said to have ended in the summer of 2009, measures of the health of small business have either stagnated or weakened. Consider what small business owners think about the effect of the economy on their businesses. In July 2009, 29% of respondents to the Discover Card Small Business Watch said their business's economic situation was improving. In October 2010, that figure was 28%. Similar numbers could be seen from the twice-a-year American Express Open Survey of small business owners. In September 2010, 17% of those surveyed said that their business risked going under because of the economic climate, up from 11% in March 2009, shortly before the recovery, or so-called recovery, began. It's not just small business owners' perceptions that are more negative now than when the recovery began. The government's numbers show the same pattern. Bureau of Labor Statistics figures show that the number of people self-employed outside of agriculture has not come back since the recovery began. A seasonally adjusted 50,000 fewer people were self-employed in September 2010 than in the first month of the recovery. Business startup rates among those out of work continue to decline. According to a survey by outplacement firm Challenger Gray and Christmas, only 3.9% of job seekers started businesses in the second quarter of 2010, a much lower percentage than in the first quarter of the recovery, when 11.8% sought to found companies. Small businesses breathe jobs into the economy, but tight credit is strangling them even as the nation slowly recovers from the worst economic downturn since the Great Depression. Banks and other lenders remain tight-fisted, frustrating many small business owners who are ready to expand. Without access to credit, business owners can't invest in new equipment or new workers. Seasonal businesses that rely on credit to smooth out dips in cash flow are finding themselves vulnerable, even though they're profitable on a yearly basis. Lenders are wary, however, because bad loans, bad mortgages bundled into securities to be exact, triggered the recession. Regulators are keeping a close eye on their balance sheets. Well, ladies and gentlemen, what can be said? I mean, how do you deal with a situation where the consumers simply are not interested in spending money? How do you expect small businesses to invest? How do you expect them to create wealth, to create employment under those circumstances? You know, here we are with no business, no recovery. Forget what they tell you about the recovery. There isn't a recovery. All there is asset inflation, the desperation by the crazed lunatics like Ben Bernanke to push prices up, to push money into the system, to push the stock market up so people feel wealthier. Where did they find this five-year-old? You know, I'm tired of having to justify his comments to people that call in and say, he thinks this, he thinks that, what do you think? The man belongs in a lunatic asylum. He doesn't belong in the Federal Reserve. He doesn't belong in any chance of economic advice. How did he ever win an economics prize? How did Alan Greenspan receive a knighthood from the Queen of England? You know, this asset inflation cure has been tried before. It has failed every single time. These bubbles formed as asset prices soared beyond sustainable valuations. There was strong economic growth during the late 1990s to 2000 tech bubble, but it was all a mirage. When the Fed tried to pull away from the easy money conditions by raising its Fed funds rate and mopping up excess liquidity, we all know what happened. When stocks plunged, economic activity plummeted with it. The internet companies with no profits and sometimes not even any revenues closed down or laid off most of their employees. There was so much malinvestment, particularly in telecommunications capacity, that it took years for it to be worked off. Industry giants such as Nortel, Lucent, and Motorola laid off hundreds of thousands of workers. Lucent was driven into Alcatel's arms. Nortel, peak market valuation of $250 billion, give me a break, was driven into bankruptcy. Motorola never fully recovered. The party was fun while it lasted, but the hangover was deadly. And to combat the recessionary effects of the imploded tech bubble, the Fed slashed rates again in 2001 to 2004, helping to create a housing bubble and driving house prices to levels that were unaffordable for first-time homebuyers. The Fed wantonly abandoned its banking oversight responsibilities. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, there were plenty of regulations and plenty of regulators. All that there was a lack of was the ability and the degree and the desire for these people to do their jobs. All they could do was encourage the creation of these wacky mortgages, the subprime, no money down, interest only, negative amortization mortgages, so that first-time home buyers could afford the higher-priced offers. And during this period of easy money and Fed encouragement, the leveraged mortgage market, packaged collateralized mortgage obligations, CMOs and collateralized debt obligations, the CDOs, took off. Homeowners were encouraged to take out trillions of dollars of equity from their inflated home prices. This too was quite a party. The cash-out money drove home renovations, stainless steel kitchen appliance sales, vacations, computer purchases. Jobs were created directly related to housing, construction workers, mortgage brokers, real estate brokers, appraisers, mortgage bond salesmen, and indirectly state and local government employees, for example. Stocks soared to record highs, though not mostly tech stocks, creating even more so-called wealth. Once again, when the Fed tried to pull back from the easy credit conditions, the bubble burst. Home prices plunged 30-40% back to 2003 levels. The credit markets imploded and stocks lost half their value. Oh, the party was fun while it lasted, but the hangover was even deadlier than before. Throughout the last decade, now considered, of course, a lost decade, the United States lost focus and became increasingly uncompetitive with the rest of the world. Spending was encouraged, saving discouraged. The U.S. piled up debts, capital investment lagged and was often misdirected into housing or into glutted fiber optic networks. The country lost a third of its manufacturing jobs, 20% of its technology jobs. Many of the jobs moved overseas permanently to lower cost and more receptive locales. This loss of focus was an unintended consequence of the Fed's easy credit asset bubble policies. Today, with Fed-controlled interest rates already at zero, the Fed has resorted to an even more aggressive policy to combat the weak economy, money printing. Oh, money printing sounds too cool. The central bankers came up with a fancy new name for it. Who wants it to be easy? Money printing is a time-honored last resort for desperate governments with structural problems weighing on their economies. The United States is in such bad shape that even 0% interest rates and $1.7 trillion of money printing in QE round one was not sufficient to stimulate enough growth to reduce unemployment. Nevertheless, Bernanke believes that money printing is a success, as it has eased financial conditions in the past and so far looks to be effective again. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, those are his words. So he's pouring on another $600 billion. But once again, he's targeting asset prices to generate a wealth effect, just as the Fed had done last decade. It didn't work then, and it won't work now. Jeremy Grantham, chairman of GMO, one of the largest fund managers in the world, and who accurately foresaw and warned of prior bubbles, calls quantitative easing to, quote, the last desperate step of an ineffective plan to stimulate the economy through higher prices, regardless of any future costs, end of quote. Legendary investor Jimmy Rogers said last month of the Fed's plan, and I quote, printing money isn't the right thing to do, but they don't know that. They're not very smart people. That's why they're in Washington, end of quote. I ask you, has there ever been a Ponzi scheme so brazen? And I ask you, and I answer you, has not. Ladies and gentlemen, all Ponzi schemes eventually collapse, either under their own weight or through intervention by the authorities. And this one will be no exception. You know, I understand that a bailout of Ireland and Portugal is better for the markets than a crash and burn, but I am surprised at the euphoric atmosphere as we get closer to the biggest sovereign blow-up in a very long time. And of course, talking of sovereign blow-ups, there's one happening almost every day in the U.S. municipal bond market. Philadelphia and San Francisco have been downgraded. And this is, of course, very upsetting to the muni bond players. A town in Michigan called Hamtramck has requested permission to file bankruptcy, always upsetting. Even more upsetting is that their request has been denied. This muni has been broken for years, but rather than go bankrupt and wipe out the unpayable liabilities, the plan is for a bailout. A dangerous precedent, as it just puts more debt pressure at the state level. Prices are falling hard and fast. Munis will be forced to pay up big time to roll maturities into new bonds. They will obviously face prohibitive pricing. Given that the worst and biggest borrowers have the largest populations, a disruption in the financing markets for these biggies will translate into big cutbacks in employment. It is not possible for that to happen without it ripping a big hole in total GDP and pushing unemployment way above 10%. And I'm talking about the U3 measure now, not the U6 measure, which will go way above 25%. We know we have DC gridlock. There will be no stimulus program that bails out the states. A bailout that was directed to California at the expense of Texas is not going to go over at all. I would call that a non-starter. And that being the case, what is the only option left? Simple. The Fed buying munis. I can't believe it's going to happen. Yet, frankly, I can't believe it isn't. Of course, that would be the very last act before the cliff. Ireland has been dragged and kicked into a bailout. The bond market forced them into it. When yields screamed to peak near the 2-year just a week ago, the jig was up. Well, California will be following fast in Ireland's footsteps. It will be no different. If the 2-year cost of money rises to about 80% of the 20-year yield, we will have a crisis and a bailout. Ladies and gentlemen, do not be surprised by all of this. I saw this coming years ago. The only surprise is the length of time it has taken to happen. I've warned you to stay away from the municipal bond market. Questions about municipal bonds are probably the most common I have had to deal with since the real estate blow-up. There is no pretense of an end to this, either in Europe or in the States with munis. Forget moral hazard. Once you start down this road, there is absolutely no place to stop. If they bail one muni, they'll have to buy them all. It's interesting that a state bailout never goes up for votes. That would be political suicide. Imagine Texas or South Carolina giving a vote on a bailout for California or Illinois state pensioners. Oh, well, the all-powerful federal government agency machine will take taxes away from people in the 50 states and give somewhat less back to the same poor people in the 50 states and the around 30,000 incorporated munis and towns and cities. In 2002, the National League of Cities put the total at 19,429 municipal governments in the United States. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I don't know what to tell you. I don't know whether I shall always be considered the bearer of gloom and doom, but I don't see any way out of this. I see no light at the end of any tunnel. And I have no joy to bring you for Thanksgiving this year. None whatsoever. I can only hope that you will enjoy it, that you will have a good time, that you will try not to get frisked too much. Groped, I believe, is the new word. I don't know which is better, to be groped or to go through the naked machine, but one way or another, I wish you a wonderful one, ladies and gentlemen. Take care of yourselves. Have a wonderful Thanksgiving. There will be no show on Friday. I'll be back on Monday. Take care. Bye-bye.